My name's Scott Ritter. I'm a former Marine Corps intelligence officer. I did some couple years as a chief inspector with the United Nations in Iraq, and since my resignation from that position in 1998, I've been involved in doing geopolitical analysis and a fairly harsh critic of American foreign policy.
15, 20 years down the line, what have you actually learnt now? Because we know at the time when we're doing whatever it is we're doing on the global stage, sometimes, and I'm absolutely sure you're going to tell me in your case, you learn in the succeeding years a lot about what was really going on. So can you just give us an idea of what you've learnt since from that experience as a weapons inspector there?
Well, one of the main things I've learned is, it's how you frame a problem that gives you the solution, and that a lot of people take a look at the outcome without first examining, how the problem was framed to begin with. And I'll give you an example. I first cut my arms control teeth doing weapons inspections in the former Soviet Union. In fact, I helped write the book on on-site inspection. It was the first time meaningful compliance verification integrated on-site inspection into its overall regime. It was, to implement a treaty that was bilateral in nature between the United States and the Soviet Union to get rid of nuclear weapons. Good treaty, but it was bilateral, which means that there was issues of reciprocity involved, meaning that whatever the United States did, the Soviet Union would do in return. It was in both sides' interest to have a positive outcome here. I carried this experience of on-site inspection with me to the United Nations. And when I first started working at the United Nations, it was basically an INF treaty type mode of operations that we were operating in, meaning we were doing a gentleman's agreement, where one side was supposed to provide us with a complete declaration listing the totality of the material that was involved in the disarmament undertaking. And then we as inspectors would verify this and then oversee the destruction, dismantling, dismemberment of this weaponry. What we didn't factor in is that there's no reciprocity involved here. And the Iraqis had a vested interest to lie to us and retain material in violation of this agreement. And so the inspection process became something much different. It became a forensic investigation, searching for lies as opposed to truth. And it was a process that while we as inspectors faithfully undertook it, it was a process that could be manipulated because there was no reciprocity. It allowed the United States to claim a policy of disarmament and yet use the access granted to inspectors for purposes other than disarmament. For instance, collecting intelligence on Saddam Hussein in an effort to remove him from power. Regime change was the policy, not disarmament. And so, what I learned from that is when I look at the outcome, which of course was an absolute fumbled disarmament operation, even though the inspectors were successful politically, we were never able to get the recognition of our success. A lot of people look at that and say, "Oh man, that was a failure." But I say, no. We got to go back and look at how the problem was framed. The UN process in Iraq was never framed as a disarmament process. It was always framed as regime change by the United States. They just tried to confuse everybody by saying, "No, this is really about disarmament."
So what you're saying there, I suppose, about Iraq, you could kind of say about Afghanistan too, because it certainly looks as if the hunt for Osama bin Laden wasn't the real reason to be there. I wonder what you make, first of all, the reasons for being in Afghanistan and this recent during August withdrawal. And, the wider question, of course, is why now? So can you just take us through Afghanistan? Firstly, why there? And secondly, why are we leaving now? The United States, Britain, and NATO?
Well, let's start off by again using what I talked about in the arms control world, how a problem is framed. Understand that problems can be reframed as they progress, that you can start with the intention of doing something, and then later on, as the situation develops, you'll reframe your objectives. And that's what happened in Afghanistan. It was just a continuous reframing of objectives. We started actually with a very pure operation. Wrongheaded, I believe, but pure, meaning that the United States was attacked by terrorists on 9/11. Thousands of Americans and people of other nationalities were killed on that date. And the president determined that we would seek revenge against those who perpetrated the attack. It was determined that Al-Qaeda, an organization, the base, headed by a gentleman named Osama bin Laden, was responsible. And we decided that we were going to go into Afghanistan, where Osama bin Laden resided, together with the bulk of his Al-Qaeda organization, and we were going to annihilate him.
Well, hang on, that doesn't make any sense, because he's a Saudi, and almost all the hijackers were Saudis.
But he lived in Afghanistan. We're not going after Saudis. We were going after Osama bin Laden, and we were going after the Al-Qaeda organization, which was based out of, at least the main party of it was based out of Afghanistan. So that's why we went there. And again, they were there as guests of this organization called the Taliban, which at the time was the government of Afghanistan, although at the time only a few nations recognized it as such. Most nations recognized it as this this mob of Islamic fundamentalists who had been engaged in a civil war with other elements in Afghanistan, and whose ruling methodology was deemed to be medieval in nature, especially when it came to women. And the Taliban, being based out of Kandahar originally, which is in southern Afghanistan, is primarily a Pashto organization, meaning they're from the Pashto tribes. And they had invited bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda members to Afghanistan after bin Laden had been chased out of other nations, Saudi Arabia, Sudan. They brought him in under what's called Pashtunwali, which is a very complex tribal code that basically says, when we bring you in and bring you under our protection, we guarantee your protection. But there's a two-sided street to that, meaning that while you're under our protection, you cannot violate the rules, the norms, the standards of the Pashtun tribes and of Islamic law. And when 9/11 occurred, the Taliban actually did reach out and talk with the United States through intermediaries and others and say, hey, if bin Laden and Al-Qaeda did what you say he did, he's violated Pashtunwali. And this is unacceptable. And while we won't turn him over to you, we will turn him over to a third party for Islamic justice, and we will evict Al-Qaeda from Afghanistan if you just show us the proof that he was involved. But, at that point in time, we were in the business of stacking bodies. It wasn't about getting a just outcome. It was about getting an outcome that that made Americans feel good. And in order to do that, we had to kill people. We had to kill a lot of people. And no better way to kill a lot of people than expand our war in Afghanistan to include not just bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, but now all of the Taliban. So our war transformed. It went from simply hunting down Al-Qaeda to now destroying the Taliban and removing them from power. And when you opt to remove a government from power, you create a vacuum that you are now obligated to fill. And in doing so, you've now incurred a nation-building requirement, a nation-building task. And that's what happened. That's how we went from simply trying to kill Osama bin Laden to being neck deep in a nation building exercise in Afghanistan. It didn't start out that way, but that's the way it ended it up.
Hang on a minute. The Taliban are potentially your allies helping you round up the mastermind of 9/11. And you decide you're going to, instead of working with them to get hold of him, you're going to attack them. The one organization in the world that can actually help you to get hold of the perpetrator of 9/11.
Look, this is, in a nutshell, you just described the debate I had with Richard Holbrooke, who later on became the czar, so to speak, of Afghan-Pakistan relations under Obama. But, I basically, in a debate I had with him on the History Channel in October of 2001, I said, look, the best policy we can have here is avoid putting American boots on the ground, and instead work with the Taliban to isolate Al-Qaeda Osama bin Laden and get him removed. This also means we need to work with Afghanistan's neighbors, the Pakistanis, the Iranians, the various former Soviet republics, to work with us so that when they receive bin Laden, we can be assured that he will be treated in a manner which prevents him ever again threatening the United States. This will require us to work with moderate elements within the Taliban. And Holbrooke laughed and said, there are no moderate Taliban. Well, he didn't know what he was talking about. There were moderate Taliban at the time. A guy named Mudawakil was the foreign minister. He was moderate. He was surrounded by others who were moderate. And even Mullah Omar, who was the leader, is the one who said, if you violate Pushtun Wali, you will pay a price. But no, the problem was, see, what I'm laying out here to you about respecting Pashtun tribal culture, respecting Pushtun Wali, and respecting people to adhere to a code that has defined their life requires a level of understanding of the cultural norms and history of that region that the average American politician lacks. And the average American is ill-equipped to embrace readily. After 9/11, the American people weren't prepared to sit down and be lectured to by people like me about how the best way forward to avoid a quagmire would be to negotiate with the Taliban, to work with the Taliban, to neutralize bin Laden in a manner that reduced collateral damage, reduced potential harm to Americans, reduced potential harm to innocent Afghan civilians. That would require a lot of explaining. And one thing I learned in the military early on when I was standing in front of a general explaining that what I did was actually right, he shut me up. He said, Lieutenant, when you're explaining, you're losing. And the fact that you're standing here before me today explaining something means you lost. Get out of my office. This is true for American politicians. The moment they start explaining something to their constituency, they've lost. They can't get involved in complex discussions with their constituents, especially after such an event as 9/11, where what people wanted was revenge. Bloodlust was up. It was easier to tell the American people, we're going in, we're going to wade into Afghanistan, and we're going to slaughter bin Laden, we're going to slaughter al-Qaeda, we're going to slaughter the Taliban. And the American people would thump their chests, give three or four oohs, and say, this is great, as opposed to saying, hey, I know you guys want blood, but this is what we're going to do. We're going to actually hold back on the troops, and we're going to engage in this process that might take a couple months to explain to bin Laden or explain to Mullah Omar and the Taliban why bin Laden's a bad guy. And then bin Laden will be transferred to a third party. And then it's going to probably take us a couple more months to get an outcome that is satisfactory to us. You'd be cut off at the knees the second you started having that conversation with the American people in the 2001, the post 9/11, 2001, 2002 timeframe. It was much easier just to say, no, we're sending the boys in, we're stacking bodies. Because that's something the American people understood, and that's something they were prepared to undertake.
Yeah, but you see, sometimes in situations like September the 11th attacks, the response might be far worse than the attacks themselves and actually send the nation or the world on a collision course and actually into a disastrous area. Particularly when, deciding, right, we're just going to tear up the rule book of the UN and start doing regime changes here, there and everywhere. And also, of course, there is the fact that we know now there are some quite serious questions about 9/11 as to whether bin Laden from his cave in Afghanistan was really the mastermind. Now we know about the collapse of Building 7, which wasn't hit by a plane. We also know about the complete non-appearance, it seems, of the United States Air Force in intercepting those jets and the collapse of the, most supposedly the best prepared and most powerful air defense in the world, Scott.
Well, I'm not going to get into 9/11. What I will say is that if you wanted to take out the masterminds of 9/11, the place to bomb would have been Hamburg, Germany, because that's where 9/11 was planned, according to the narrative that the U.S. government itself promotes. So, going into Afghanistan was absurd. And I think one of the big lessons of this whole 20-year fiasco is if we don't get it right at the start, the end result can be far worse than the event that initiated it. And I think that when we take a look at the totality of our 20-year debacle in Afghanistan, that harmed America and the world far more than the events of 9/11 did.
Now, I know you say you don't want to get into that, but I think you need to just explain, even just a couple of paragraphs, what you mean by Germany, because certainly, you know, I've heard all sorts of things about the 9/11 attacks, most of them to do with them being organized from Afghanistan, not Germany.
Well, I mean, that is a narrative, the organized from Afghanistan is a narrative that's promoted by the debriefings of people like Sheikh Mohammed and others who have been captured and tortured and imprisoned in Guantanamo Bay. But when we trace the 19 hijackers, they operated out of Hamburg, Germany. They operated out of a mosque. The money was brought together there, and the 19 hijackers were shipped from there around to the various locations. I mean, I'm grossly oversimplifying this, but to me, the notion that 9/11 was planned, in a cave somewhere in Afghanistan is ludicrous. We know that bin Laden was aware of 9/11. I think there's some evidence that he talked about something happening, but the notion that he planned it, that he sat there and said, no, we're going to specifically train you guys to do X to accomplish Y. I think at least the narrative that is promulgated by the United States supports, Hamburg as being the planning center for 9/11.
Well, that is definitely worth thinking about. The next time we see some sort of mass terror attack, a bit like the September 11th or anything like that, God forbid, happening again, we should be extremely wary about what we're being told at the time is the cause, and who has done it and where it's been done from, because it seems to me quite often we hear afterwards quite a lot more information than we're getting at the time. And I'm also a little bit suspicious when, you know, all the dots are joined within the first 24 hours, Scott.
Well, look, first of all, absolutely. When you claim to have absolute certainty of knowledge about, about an event that has yet to be totally comprehended, you need to be suspicious. I always operate under the notion that you can't solve a problem until you first properly define it. And what happened with our desire for revenge in Afghanistan is that we came up with a solution without first understanding exactly what occurred. I mean, it seems to me that we should have allowed a 9/11 type commission to reach a more defined understanding of what exactly happened before we started talking about taking the nation to war. But no, we rushed to judgment. And again, it's because, what happened after 9/11 was very political. I mean, we only have to listen to, people who talk about Paul Wolfowitz sitting down with the president on September 12th, talking about exploiting the events of 9/11 to carry out regime change in Iraq. There were no Iraqis on board any of those aircraft. Iraq had nothing to do with this. Iraq was a sworn enemy of al-Qaeda. And yet, here we have senior government officials talking about using 9/11 as an excuse to initiate a war of regime change with Iraq. So, yes, you're right. We need to be extraordinarily skeptical, and we have a duty and responsibility as citizens to demand answers from our government before they take us down a path of, in the case of Afghanistan, a 20-year, disaster.
Okay, so what was Afghanistan really about, and why, as NATO, the U.S. leading the Brits, etc., out? Why now?
Well, I mean, 9/11. If again, we trace it back in the immediate aftermath, the United States put a tremendous amount of pressure on NATO to execute Article 5 to say that since the United States has been attacked, NATO is now going to come to our collective self-defense. And NATO, like the compliant puppy dog that they are, they did this, and it's the only time that Article 5 has been implemented. NATO aircraft came to the United States. They had AWACS aircraft flying over, like we really needed a NATO AWACS airplane here. And they did some other things in terms of putting up boats in the Mediterranean. They had naval patrols to keep terrorists out coming from North Africa, etc. That was all under Article 5. And then we went to the United Nations, and again, we used the pain and suffering of those people who died on 9/11 to twist the United Nations into passing a series of Security Council resolutions authorizing the use of force to go into Afghanistan and stabilize the region, to begin nation building. And NATO bought into this. NATO said, well, we have that. So NATO implemented another paragraph of the NATO treaty, which is Article 4. And it's basically instead of collective self-defense, it means we can use military power to promote the security needs of a member state as needed. And so under Article 4, NATO started dispatching troops using this United Nations resolution as a cover to carry out anti-terrorism, counterterrorism, and nation-building exercises. These things called provincial reconstruction teams were dispatched and used to build up infrastructure, to create governance, to train troops, etc. And that's how NATO got involved. They got involved via the vehicle of international law. I mean, the one thing we can't say about the Afghan intervention early on is that it violated international law. Actually, it was one of the most legitimate, quote unquote, military interventions in modern history, because it had basically crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's when it came to international law. We had the United Nations, we had NATO, we had everything, brought in. Everybody supported it. the whole world supported going in there and basically rebuilding Afghanistan. What they didn't support is what the United States did after that. You see, after we brought everybody in and said, hey, we're going to let you build, reconstruct all this stuff, and we need you to work under a unified command structure, we're going to keep this other command structure in place, the counterterrorism command structure, and we're just going to go around and do whatever we want, including assassinating people, the hunt for bin Laden. We couldn't trust to an international organization. The CIA came in and recruited basically a private army. The British intelligence services came in and recruited their own army. And we did this all as separate from the Afghan government that we were trying to build, meaning that all these private secret Afghan armies that we built weren't responsive to the Afghan government. They're responsive to the CIA or British MI6 or American Special Operations, but they weren't responsive to the Afghan government. And the operations they carried out undermined the legitimacy of the Afghan government and the legitimacy of the nation building work that NATO was undertaking. So the United States invited everybody in, told them to do X, and then we did Y and undermined everything they were trying to do. I mean, that, that just shows you the insanity of what was going on in Afghanistan.
Yeah, but what was it really about? I know the Taliban, for example, had stopped the growing of poppies. I mean, if it wasn't about hunting down bin Laden in a cave, there must have been something more to it. I mean, certainly looking at it, one of the aspects to it is the absolutely massive increase in opium production there.
Here's the deal. I mean, the United States, when the CIA first came in, prior to 9/11, we already had a relationship with certain tribal elements in Afghanistan as part of our war against the Taliban. We were supporting this entity called the Northern Alliance. We were providing them with millions of dollars. And all that. And then when we intervened after 9/11 and the Taliban started to collapse, we immediately went in and started to recruit these militias that used to be allied with the Taliban, but now we bought them off. And the CIA never allowed many of these militias to be disbanded and to report to the Afghan government that we're rebuilding. Instead, we basically allowed these militias to govern over vast regions of Afghanistan and do what they wanted to do, which included growing opium or growing poppies and producing opium that was converted into heroin and stuff, and making millions of dollars doing that. This was the way that we paid off these tribal elements to remain loyal to the CIA. You know, so that's what happened. The Taliban, when we invaded, the Taliban had pretty much eradicated poppy harvesting in Afghanistan. Then we empowered these tribal elements, and that's all they did. And then what we did is, in order to win the loyalty or keep the loyalty of certain tribal elements, they said, well, wait a minute, this tribe over there is growing poppies right now, and they're competing with us. We need that to end. So we'd come in with a poppy eradication program, but we weren't eradicating poppies. We were eradicating the competition of the poppy growers that we were supporting. That's just the crazy way that we were, you know, some people say that we were manipulating Afghan tribal politics, but I would say that we're being manipulated by Afghan tribal politics, meaning that, you know, we weren't necessarily the ones calling the shots here. We were getting used by these extremely corrupt tribal leaders who made millions off of money they received directly from the CIA, but they made even more money off of growing poppies that was converted into opium.
Now, Afghanistan couldn't really be much further away from the United States of America, Scott. It's a bit difficult to justify the idea that this rather backward country is really that much of a threat to the superpower that is based in, you know, has got Washington as its capital. So obviously it's in an interesting place on the world island geopolitically. You know, you've got Iran next door, you've got Russia next door, you've got Pakistan. I mean, surely this is, you know, there's some geopolitics involved here rather than just the idea that you've got these, you know, particularly, well, there must be wonder terrorists in Afghanistan that are threatening the United States.
No, you're correct. I mean, first of all, understand that Afghanistan, we call it a nation, but it's not a nation in the traditional sense. A nation is a specific geographical entity where the population is united in a vision that reflects the will of the totality of the people involved. Afghanistan is the exact opposite. It's a conglomerate of tribes that don't necessarily get along with one another, all of whom occupy this ungovernable space. It's a nation only because its borders are defined by the ability of these ungovernable people to push back against their neighbors and prevent them from occupying them, as opposed to them trying to push out their borders and define it. So it's basically this ungovernable space. But it is located in a very, you know, critical part of the world. It's a bridge between, you know, for instance, Iran, Pakistan, and China, Iran, Pakistan, and India. Through the former Soviet republics, you get into Russia. You also have the Silk Road that leads across into Europe. So it's positioned. And what we know is that this positioning is of strategic importance. We know this. Why? Because first Jimmy Carter and then Ronald Reagan met with the Taliban met with Afghans to negotiate a pipeline that would transit Afghanistan, to bring oil from the Central Asian republics into India. We were in negotiation with them prior to 9/11. During the 1980s, we were discussing this with them all the way through into the 1990s. So the notion that we didn't know anything about Afghanistan prior to this is absurd. We also knew that Afghanistan was sitting on one of the world's largest reserves of exotic metals. During the time, you know, they've only recently gained importance because they're critical to electronics. But that's there. So, you know, there is, you know, a material wealth and element to that, but also there's an element that if you can stabilize Afghanistan and use Afghanistan as part and parcel, sort of a glue to link these Eurasian nations together, Iran, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Russia, China, Pakistan, India, and link them all together, you've created a center of gravity that directly competes with the transatlantic alliance between the United States and Europe. So it's in America's interests to continue to destabilize Afghanistan, because as long as Afghanistan's destabilized, you can't have this Eurasian linkage. And so, yes, there's a huge geopolitical element to Afghanistan that goes beyond simply bin Laden was there and launched a terror attack. We would have had a hard time explaining to the American people why we were in Afghanistan without the 9/11 attacks. But once the 9/11 attacks occurred, and we got into Afghanistan, you know, we allowed ourselves to be sucked into this geopolitical vortex without really understanding how we wanted to emerge. I think that's one of the problems, is we never really had a good end game on how this was going to end.
Well, yeah, and I'm going to press you on this again. Why now? Because, I mean, one of the, certainly as a 25-year-long journalist, I look at this as a bit of a cynical exercise. First of all, in making this during what we call here the silly season, when Parliament is in recess, and I know you have the same sort of thing during August in the United States as well, it means that it doesn't really get debated and discussed amongst politicians. And also, it fills a gap in the airwaves, which, you know, traditionally has been almost like open season. All sorts of stuff that doesn't get discussed the rest of the year and political views get an airing in August that they don't get elsewhere. So, I mean, that might be one reason why it should take place during August 2021. But anyway, what's your view on why now? Because I think most people were kind of hit as a bit. It's a bit of a surprise, really, all this. And it's a very embarrassing thing. But why now? And what does that tell us about what else might be being done with these troops, for example, that have come home now?
Well, I believe in Occam's razor, meaning the simplest explanation is usually the correct one. Let's put it this way. During the administration of George W. Bush, during the administration of Barack Obama, that's 16 years, you know, we weren't getting out of Afghanistan. We, you know, everybody struggled to define what the mission was. There were various surges, various redefining of what we were doing there. Troop levels went up, troop levels went down. Even after we killed bin Laden in 2011, we still weren't talking about getting out of there. We were heavily invested in the region, because I do think that some people started to understand the geopolitical significance of being in Afghanistan. And had a traditional American politician, for instance, had Hillary Clinton won the election in 2016, we'd still be in Afghanistan today, because she's a traditional, you know, American imperial hegemony promoting type politician. But this guy named Donald Trump won, who doesn't operate from any book that's recognized by the American establishment. And early on, he went to the generals, and he almost got sucked into the trap. The generals and the warmongers all sat down and told him how important Afghanistan was. And if they just gave him more troops and just gave him more money, they could win this thing and it would be great. And he said, OK, here's your troops. Here's your money. I'm going to loosen up rules of engagement. You can kill anybody you want to kill. Just get the job done. And then he went to him a year later and said, how's it going? They said, well, we need more troops and more money. And he was the most honest American politician we had in a long time. He looked at the generals. He looked at Mattis, Mad Dog Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, former Marine, with extensive history in Afghanistan, and he called them losers. He says, you guys can't win a war. You don't know how to win a war. You're a bunch of losers. I gave you everything you asked for, and all I get is the same. We're out of here. And he made the decision that we're getting unplugged, because he didn't buy into all the other stuff that all the other politicians had, you know, had said why we need to be there. All he said is, this is an unpopular war. We have troops over there that don't need to be there, and I'm bringing them home. And he began a process of negotiating with the Taliban, which again broke many, many rules, and actually negotiated a peace agreement, and came up with a date of withdrawal, which was May of 2021. And the whole establishment went crazy. They just didn't buy into it. We know this because he gave a direct order to the military to pull the troops down to a certain level. And we found out after he lost the election that the military just shelved that order. And instead of reducing troops, actually reinforced them. So there were more troops in Afghanistan than less troops when Donald Trump left office, because the establishment didn't want to get out of Afghanistan. That's just a reality. Now, Joe Biden is Mr. Establishment, but he was confronted with a predicament because he had this peace treaty, this peace agreement. And the Taliban were actually living up to the part of the agreement that said, we won't kill Americans as long as you're getting out. And Biden was also somebody who didn't believe in this mission long term. He, when he was vice president, he continuously told Barack Obama that he was against surging people in. He was against, promoting a continuous conflict. So he saw this as an opportunity to get out. The question is, how do we get out and when do we get out? And Biden made the decision that the best way to get out is just to get out. He tried to get agreement within his administration. They had serious meetings in March because the May deadline was coming up. And by April, he overrode everybody and said, no, we're getting out. Yes, I will tell the Taliban we need an extension of this, but we're getting out. Then he went to NATO and he told NATO, we're getting out. And he set the date. We will be out by September 11th, 2021. Now, the interesting thing about this is that was a decision he made. Now, the politician comes in. We now know that, A, he was negotiating extensively with the Taliban, that there was a deal cut between him and the Taliban on how this was going to unravel. Two, he knew that the Afghan government would collapse. He had a phone conversation with the Afghan president in March where the president said, hey, man, we're being invaded. This is all over. It's all she wrote unless you do something. And he said, what I need you to do is go out there and be positive about this, create a perception of success, even if it's not true. So Biden was telling the Afghan president to lie about the situation so that he could shape perception in the United States so that we could go forward with this withdrawal. Of course, it all came to a head when the Afghan government did, in fact, collapse. The Taliban took over the country, and now we're stuck basically, you know, holding the bag. And we had to go in and negotiate a theater of the absurd. Where we would deploy 6,000 troops into the most indefensible space in all of Afghanistan and who were totally dependent upon the mercy of the Taliban not to slaughter them, and then undertake this this humanitarian fiasco, which we called an evacuation, that resulted in an act of terror that killed 13 Americans, over 100, I think 170 Afghans. And now we have this debacle where America's out of Afghanistan, and it looks as though the Taliban won. They did win, but that's how it happened. It was basically just poorly executed policy. I don't see and England learned the hard way that when you're the poodle of the United States, unfortunately, when we say heal, you have to heal. England didn't have a choice. They have no power projection capability. They've got nothing. They can protest all they want, but at the end of the day, England had to do what the United States told them to do in Afghanistan, which is get in here, get your people out, and get out of here with us. So did the rest of Europe. Nobody had the ability to say no to the United States because the United States is the master, and they're just a bunch of puppies that follow the direction that their master tells them to go.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we had our Puma helicopters in there, and the British Royal Air Force didn't actually have the transport capability, big enough aircraft to bring those helicopters out. So we had to actually hire a massive aircraft from the Russians to get our aircraft out, which is ironic. But look, looking at it now, I mean, what you're describing there is an absolutely colossal humiliation that really does spell doom, I suppose, for any credibility for the NATO forces, and particularly for the United States as a world power.
Yes, if we lived in a world that was governed by rational thinkers, that's true. First of all, the United States is not going to learn any lesson from Afghanistan, just like we didn't learn any lesson from Vietnam. There will be a period of time where we lick our wounds and where there's some bitterness and recrimination, et cetera. But we will always continue to operate in the way that we have to operate in order to sustain who we are and what we are as a nation. We are a nation that is totally dependent upon our ability to dictate outcomes to the rest of the world, on our ability to gain access to resources we need to survive as a nation and guarantee that we acquire these resources at prices that are affordable to us without overly enriching you. We are a global empire, and until the empire totally collapses. This is the way the United States will operate, and it compels us to behave in a certain manner. And we will do this, and the world will accept this until the world can come up with the appropriate means of pushing back, whether this is a revitalized Russia, whether this is a revitalized China, whether this is a Russian-Chinese alliance, whether this is a Eurasian entity that emerges from a post-Afghan environment, whether it's a combination of the three, until there's sufficient pushback to keep the United States from behaving in this fashion, this is what the United States is going to do. Yeah, it's humiliating. So is Vietnam. We recovered from that. We'll recover from this.
Scott, your books, your latest book, can you just let our listeners know what it is, where they can get it?
Well, the latest book is it's called Scorpion King. It's a history of America's addiction to nuclear weapons from FDR to Donald Trump. It's published by Clarity Press. You can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Nobles, any of the online booksellers.
Okay, Scott Ritter, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.